welcome to another episode of the Monday Mile podcast. This week, we're linking up with Team GB rugby sensation, Abby Burton. Now, Abby's story is far from normal. A Tokyo 2020 Olympian and an athlete campaigning to improve body confidence. Her career hasn't been straightforward, with a serious bout of ill health in 2022 and a misdiagnosis of experiencing a psychotic episode actually turned out to be autoimmune encephalitis. Abby, welcome to the Monday Mile podcast.
Oh, this is super cool. No, look at the sun, sun shining, walking by the river, couldn't ask for anything better.
It's a vibe, isn't it?
It is.
How are you today?
I'm doing good. Like, as I said, being outside is just my happy place. So, yeah, doing good. How is yourself?
You know what? I'm really, really good. And I'm so excited to have a little chat with you because your story is quite mind-boggling. And seeing you turn up today and your smile, it's so, so infectious. First off, why rugby? Because it seems as though it's in the Burton blood.
Yeah, so traditionally, well, growing up, I didn't actually play rugby at all. Like, literally, just watched my dad and my brothers play, and that was it. Like, I'd really competitive in swimming and athletics, do every other sport other than rugby. But I always wanted to be like my dad, and I think that's... I know it's so cliche, isn't it? Oh, you want to be like your parents, but I've always just wanted to do what anything that he did, and having two younger brothers as well who were always a bit rough and tumble. You always got involved in it, even in the living room. I tell you, I've been tackled onto the
What's
sofa.
What's the age difference?
So 2 years.
2 years.
Yeah, so they're actually like grown men now, but yeah, I like to say that they're my little baby brothers. So
you definitely won't be tackling them now.
No, definitely not. They are a lot bigger than me now. I'd actually get brayed now.
So from swimming to rugby.
Yeah, there's just something about it that like just makes me me. It makes me whole and it brings out all the best characteristics of me, and that's why I love it so much, and that's why like I carry on doing it now. So yeah,
take me to that moment. Olympics, Tokyo 2020.
Yes,
you are officially named as a part of the Team GB team.
Literally, I came home from camp because we'd had a camp, and then they said, oh, we'll send out selection as soon as you get home. I was so nervous that the only thing that could calm my nerves was a Toby Carvery. So I said to my mum, I was like, Mum, we need to go to Toby Carvery. So me and one of my brothers went. My other brother didn't want to be anywhere near me in case it was bad news. It came through at 7 p.m. and literally I remember looking at my phone and I was like, it's 6:58. Like, I don't know, Mum. I don't know if I'm going to go. And literally it came up and I was just bursting into tears and it was so emotional. And at that moment, I watched my mum and dad in the kitchen and they were just like crying their eyes out. Like, and I think it's just the look on each other's faces, like she's actually done it. Like, I've wanted to do that all my life, from being a swimmer, being part of an athletics team as well, and then finally being able to go to the Olympics, even just in rugby, was just unbelievable.
So you sat at Toby Carvery. Did you go chicken or beef?
Oh, I go pork.
Oh, controversial. And you're waiting for an email.
Well, we'd actually gone home from the Toby Carvery at that point. I wish that we were actually at the Toby Carvery when it happened, but no, we had gone home after that and we were just sat in the kitchen, just like all just waiting for it to come through.
And what was that experience like going to the Olympics as a part of Team GB, wearing the uniform? Because it is different to what you do every day.
Yeah.
I've experienced it.
Yeah, it's pretty unique, isn't it, really? Like, just even from getting the kit, we never get kit like that. With the rugby stuff, we kind of get the bare minimum, and I know it's harsh to say, but we do. And then the fact that just even the kitting out and then being able to say that, like, I'm part of... Because rugby's only been in the Olympics, but this Tokyo was the second season that it had ever been in the Olympics. So I was only the second person ever to wear the number 3 shirt out of the whole of women's rugby for Great Britain. I feel like that's pretty cool in itself. And the experience of the Olympics was very mixed, like with us coming fourth. But actually, I wouldn't change it for the world. It was one of the greatest experiences that I've ever had.
Being in the mix with other sports as well, how did you find the actual games time environment? Because that's definitely something for me that I thrived off.
It was obviously a bit unique because of COVID. So like we actually couldn't communicate or like go near other athletes. So if you wanted a photo, you were standing like 2 meters away from people. Just to be able to see all these incredible athletes and just think that I'm among like the best in the world, which you never kind of think of yourself, do you?
Yeah,
like,
no.
That, and I was in, when like the food hall's at another level, it's unbelievable, like the amount of people are in there who have just dedicated their life to the sport. And I guess that's kind of a weird way to think about it when you're sitting eating dinner, like literally, but that's what I thought about, that I'm surrounded by people who think the exact same as what I do, which is quite a unique experience, I think.
It's like a seal and a stamp. You are one of the world's elite.
Yeah.
You've been recognised as one of the best in the world. Do you hold that close to your chest?
It's difficult because like sometimes I don't think of it like that, but actually I sometimes have to help myself get to that point of like, oh, I am actually one of the best in the world, especially when I have like low confidence and stuff like that. It's definitely one of those experiences that only the best in the world have ever had, so no one can ever take that away from me.
Do you suffer with low confidence?
I used to a lot before I was poorly, just feeling not good enough and just feeling like, from like a body image point of view, but then also that within sevens rugby, I don't look like a typical sevens player. I'm a lot heavier than the majority of sevens players. I'm not as quick. And I struggle to figure out where I actually fit into an actual squad because I don't look like sevens players per se. And that just affected my confidence so much, especially from when I was 18, probably until the Olympics. Like I really, really struggled with my confidence and just didn't feel like I was good enough to be in the squad.
You played in 15s. Prior to that, and
yeah.
Still do now. Was the sevens like an automatic transition, or was it just that Olympic target?
It was the Olympic target. Like, as I said, that I'm not really like a sevens built player, so I didn't even ever think that it would be on my radar to be able to play sevens at the Olympics. And I got a call one day after I'd finished my last day level exam saying, oh, we want you to be a part of the Olympic sevens squad. And I was like, okay, like I didn't never thought I'd ever get
That's
an opportunity
huge.
Like that. It was crazy. I'd literally sat my last A-level exam, 18 years old, and they were like, yep, you need to pack up your stuff, move down to London at 18 years old. I'd lived away at home at college, but like this was a whole different kettle of fish. Like I was going like 4.5 hours away from my family. It never was like a direct route for me. I always thought that, yeah, I want to probably go to a World Cup. I want to go and play my rugby that way. And I kind of, and it sounds weird, but I'd come to the realisation that I might never go to an Olympics because I'm not the build for it. I'm not like a natural sevens player. So then when I did, I was like, oh, this is pretty cool.
Smash down that barrier, having none of that. Take me to 2022 and the misdiagnosis, because this is terrifying.
I got misdiagnosed to begin with my illness. But basically in May 2022, I started just acting a bit strange, like a bit.
And when you say strange,
so strange, what my friends describe strange as for me was like, we'd be having a conversation like this and you'd be talking to me and I'd just look straight through you. Like I wouldn't even engage in the conversation. I wouldn't even act like I want to speak to you. Or you'd be talking and I'd just walk away from you. Even when I was on the rugby pitch, like some of the girls, one of my teammates, Amy Wilson Hardy, she said to me that we had like a quick tap and you were just stood there and I'm shouting like, Bertie, go, like move. And I literally overtook you to get to where we needed to go to. And I never like that. So strange in that respect that I just wasn't myself. And I'm very bubbly and outgoing. I like to think I'm the life of the party. But, and I just wasn't that at all. So that's kind of what strange was.
And how long did that episode last for before it became, hey, there's something seriously wrong?
Yeah. So the episode of like me being kind of strange and stuff lasted until my first seizure. So people knew that I was kind of ill and they basically put it down to I had depression before I had my first seizure. So then said I had depression, got sent home from camp, which was the first tournament to have World Cup qualifiers. And they sent me home. This is the first tournament that I've never not been selected for since I was 18 years old. And they sent me home and said, we don't think you're right.
Were you aware in that moment? Were you aware there was something wrong?
From what I remember at the time, I just thought I had depression, like, and I didn't know why. I just thought I was unhappy. I couldn't have told you why I was unhappy. Like, I had everything. Like, why would I have been unhappy? I think that that's the weird part of it. But the conversation about me not being selected, like, I don't even remember. That's just what my coach has now retold me. Got sent home from camp. So this is across the end of May, coming into June. And then definitely from June time, I have no, like, kind of memory at all until after then I woke back up in August.
So that's quite a long period of time for things to be off tick.
Yeah, when you think about it, it's a massive, like, period of time where you're just kind of a bit out of the loop. Yeah,
there. Sort of surviving.
Yeah, exactly. From what my mum and everybody else has told me, I had a seizure on the 15th of June. It lasted for like, mum said it lasted for like 6 minutes, and then I didn't come back around from it for an hour and a half. And I had the seizure while sat at the dinner table with my mum, just across from one another. We were talking about rugby, about like university, because I didn't think that I was going to finish my university degree because I thought I was stupid. Just before that, mum just said I was getting progressively worse and worse. Like, I was trying to do one of my uni assessments and I would sit at the table like smacking my head because I thought I was stupid. And then, yeah, had the first seizure, got sent to hospital. They said, oh, it's happened once, it won't happen again. And then that's when my behaviour changed from this kind of depressive state to manic. And that's when I just basically, like, something must have just flicked in my head of, like, fight or flight. Like, I learn a lot about psychology and fight or flight. Literally, I must have just gone off the rails, and that's what I did. I was punching my mum in the face. I was ripping banisters off in the house, trying to get out of the house unclothed. And this all spanned over a period of 3 days before eventually I got sectioned.
That is terrifying for not only you, because you've fully lost control of your mind and body, but your parents to see their daughter breaking down in front of them with no real explanation.
Exactly, like, because I don't remember it at all. Like, when my mum tells me all of this, I'm like, did that really happen? Like, did I really pull the banisters off in the house and try and hit you with them? Like, I am like a teddy bear off the pitch. Like, I would never dream of doing anything like that. Over the period of the next 3 days, so had my first seizure on a Friday and then the Saturday and the Sunday. So my next seizure on the Saturday, I was watching Love Island with my brother on the sofa. So my brother's 21 years old, has to put me in the recovery position, watching his big sister have a seizure. And then the day after, I had another one just in bed. And then they took me to the hospital and they said, oh, we think you might need to get her assessed because we don't know if she's fit to stay at home, because all they saw was the manic behaviour, my mum said. All they saw was that I was aggressive and everything. And then that's when they got me assessed and said I had stress-induced psychosis. So that's then when I got sectioned in Fieldhead Hospital, which is a psychiatric hospital in Wakefield.
That is crazy. Like, first of all, having a seizure.
Yeah.
Over 3 days.
I had three over 3 days, but then after I got sectioned, I was having seizures nearly every day. So I was having, I think it's called catatonic, and there's another one, but then absent seizures as well. And I'd have like lip smacking seizures and like face twitching. So there's loads of different types, but I was just having so many. But from what my mum said, they just ignored it. And they were treating me with antipsychotics. They didn't give me any anti-seizure medication at that time. So it's a bit of a weird one when you think about it.
I can imagine that was extremely difficult for your parents. Because you're just a void of yourself.
Yeah, 100%. Like, my mum and dad, they're very, very strong individuals. And to watch their, like, little girl go through that must have been horrific for them. Like, some days, my mum said when I was sectioned that they wouldn't even let her and my dad see me, because some days I had to be put in isolation because I was too aggressive towards the nurses and doctors. And my mum was saying, like, there was one day when we were walking like how we are now, and my mum said to my dad, apparently, what do you think they'd do if we just took her? Like, we just take her, because we don't know what they're trying to do with her. Should we just take her and just take her away? And my dad's like, I don't think we can do that, Sarah.
Wow. And at what point was it where the step was taken, finally, to diagnose you? Because the situation couldn't be further from the reality.
Yeah, so it was actually a researcher within the Mid Yorkshire Trust saw my notes just like on the files, and basically, apparently he was like, I've met him since, and he said that I was just sat up at night just thinking about it. And then I'd never seen a case of yours before, but I'd read about it before and I just thought, I know what it is. And then the next day he then asked my dad, he came into the hospital and said, can I take your daughter's blood? My dad consented, they took my blood, sent it off to Oxford Experimental Lab. And it came back positive with my type of encephalitis, which is an autoimmune encephalitis, not a viral encephalitis. So viral encephalitis can be from like bites or like infections, stuff like that, but mine was autoimmune. So my body basically thought my brain was in trouble, sent loads of antibodies to my brain. The antibodies were like, no, we don't want to be in there. So they're fighting and then they cause inflammation. That's basically what happens. Got diagnosed, wasn't moved to the hospital straight away. And one of the nurses found me having a seizure and just thought, no, we've had enough now. Let's just send her. Let's send her to the hospital. So then I was sent to Pinderfields Hospital, which is just next to Fieldhead. So got sent there, but originally was put on the incorrect ward. So I was on an acute assessment ward, not on a stroke and neurology unit. So it was just getting worse and worse and worse. Like, still aggressive. I was like rugby tackling the security guards in Pinderfields, like taking them out completely.
I bet you did as well, didn't you?
Yeah, probably. Literally. Oh, honestly, when the security saw me just before I left hospital.
I bet they were scared of
me. They literally went, hi, Abby, you all right? And I said, yeah, I'm fine, thanks. And he's like, do you remember us? And I was like, no. He's like, oh, well, we remember you because you flattened us a few times. And I was like, oh, okay.
Wow.
Eventually was moved into the right ward. I was so poorly at that point. So then they said to my dad, oh, like, we're going to have to put her in a medically induced coma because we can't manage her anymore. She can't have the treatment awake. Because any time I was awake, I was pulling, like, the cannulas out of my neck. Like, I've got scars on my neck and my arms from, like, just pulling the cannulas out. And
at that point, you were totally unaware of what you're doing.
Oh, yeah. I don't even remember, like, anything from that period of time. Like, genuinely, when people say to me, do you remember? I'm like, I genuinely could not eat. I couldn't tell you what Fieldhead, the psychiatric hospital, even looked like. I could not even tell you. And I find that absolutely mental. Like, that part of my memory has just gone. So was put in the coma, originally meant to be in there for 4 days. That turned into 3.5 weeks. And I had like pneumonia twice while I was in there. I kept having loads of seizures. I had 7 plasma exchanges, which basically they strip all the blood out of your body and put new blood in. Steroids, everything, basically just try and get this down. And then I had this form of chemotherapy called rituximab, which basically stopped the seizures. So it's like this miracle drug, basically, that is the only make in America, and it's mental. Had that. A few days after that, they felt it was necessary to wake me up. So had my last seizure on the 4th of August, and then they woke me up on the 9th of August, and then I started to realise where I was. And when I woke up, I thought I'd had a baby. Like, I thought I was a nurse. I had no clue what was wrong with me. The first couple of days, like, I literally, you don't think about getting out of bed. You just like laid there and just let people just like move you about and wash your hair. And it's a bit bizarre. Like, I can't really explain it. Like, it's just so strange.
And at the time when they put you into the medically induced coma, were they confident that they could bring you back?
No. I don't, like, from what my parents have said, they weren't. They knew they could treat me, but they didn't know, like, if I was going to wake up with brain damage or not, because it just affects your so many different parts of your brain. And because I kept having constant seizures, they didn't know what I was going to wake up like. And Mum said there were some days, especially when I had pneumonia, that they were like, we could lose her today. Like, my family members flew in from America to make sure that if something did happen, that they were there. It's crazy to think about that I couldn't be here.
So you wake up 3.5 weeks later.
Yep.
20 kilos lighter.
Yep.
Do you wake up as Abby or do you wake up in a different state?
Yeah, so I woke up as Abby. Like, I remember saying to some of the nurses when I woke up, do you know I play rugby? Like, yes, we do. And I was like, oh, like, I went to the Olympics. And they were like, yeah, we know you did. Even just rubbish, stupid chat, like, just trying to give people. From what I remember, I did wake up as Abby just with a very, very husky and croaky voice. I had to have a tube down my throat. Maybe my mum and dad would say differently, but...
For your parents, that must have felt like a miracle.
Oh, yeah, 100%. Like, the first time when I seeing my mum and dad, we just all held hands and just all three of us were just crying. And I didn't even know why I was crying either, because like I hadn't seen them. I don't remember anything until I woke up. So I don't even remember like why I was crying. I'm just holding their hands and we're all looking at each other, and then just like floods of tears are coming out. And I don't even know why. And I felt that just showed like how much emotion was in the situation.
You're now back on the pitch.
Mm-hmm.
Quite the drastic turnaround,
yeah.
Which is incredibly impressive.
Yeah.
Does it scare you that it could happen again?
I think For me, because we don't know what's caused it, however, speaking to different neurologists and stuff like that, they have made it abundantly clear that they think it's safe for me to return to rugby. And they've said that if I'm going to relapse, it is not going to be down to rugby, if that makes sense. Like, yeah. Me hitting my head would not cause me to relapse because it wasn't my head being hit in the first place that caused me to have encephalitis. They have said, though, that if I was a boxer or something like that, then I would never be able to do that again. So if I did any direct head contact sports, I would not be able to do anything again. They've just said, if I'm going to relapse, I'll relapse. They can't stop it. And for me, I can't live my life in fear of if I'm going to relapse or not. Like, and I feel like that's the kind of mindset that I do have now.
Traditionally, is it something that once treated, you are sort of safe, or is there a trending theme of relapsation?
Because my illness was only discovered in 2007, my type of encephalitis, they don't really have that much research on it. A lot of people do relapse, I'm not going to lie to you, but a lot of people didn't have the treatment that I had. So I had the rituximab, which is the aggressive chemotherapy. One dose of chemotherapy while I was asleep and one whilst I was awake, which was the stuff that caused me to lose my hair, made my face all spotty. Like, it was a necessary evil, as my mum would say. But then after that, I was on like 21 tablets a day, which consisted of like two types of anesthesia medication, steroid, calcium tablets, because they thought I could just have a stress fracture. I was a pretty much a mess after I came out of hospital, but they're pretty certain that because of how aggressively they treated it,
yeah,
I won't relapse. And like, my doctor,
that's unreal.
She looked me in the eye and said, I do not think you're going to relapse. And I was like, thank you very much. Let's hope I don't. There always will be a chance.
Yeah. That,
like, I seen a neurologist and he said, you could relapse in 2 months. You could relapse in 5 years. Could relapse in 20 years. Like, they don't have enough research on it to be able to tell me the chance of me relapsing or not.
Now, what's so incredible is how you have continued to move forward in such a positive manner. Has it changed your outlook and perspective on life?
Oh, completely. Like, pre-illness, rugby was my everything. And being a professional athlete, you'll know that your sport, majority of the time, it is everything, isn't it?
Yeah.
For me now, I look at my experience and look at life, because there was a point at the start of this year where they thought I'd probably never be able to play again. And you come to the realisation of, is it your everything? And actually, it's not. Rugby isn't my everything anymore. My health, my happiness, and my family and friends' health and happiness is what means the most to me. And next year we have Paris selection. And if I don't get selected for Paris, it is not the end of the world anymore. Whereas if you would have said that to 20-year-old Abby fighting for a place in Tokyo,
yeah,
like, that probably would have destroyed my world. But actually now, after going through what I've went through, it's changed my complete perspective on life. But it also means that I do actually enjoy rugby a little bit more than what I used to, which is weird, because you'd think if I don't care about that aspect, I still care about it, but you don't, like, it's not everything to you anymore.
Yeah.
But I enjoy it more now because I'm more relaxed. I'm not worrying about that this is my everything. I'm going to be unhappy if I drop a ball in training. I'm literally just like, yeah, next thing. Now, it's just changed everything completely for me.
Would you say it's changed what you're defined by?
Oh,
essentially.
1,000%. I'm no longer defined by Abby Burton on the rugby pitch. Like, I'm defined by the different actions that I do out of that. Like, my coaching. Like, the fact that I was able to finish my university degree after doing it for 6 years part-time and also going through a brain injury. I've watched my young brothers grow into grown men. Like, that's what makes me happy, and that's what defines me now, is my own happiness, not my happiness on a rugby pitch.
So, so magic to hear. It's giving me goosebumps. And when you're on the pitch now, how has it changed that approach? Because there's a lot of people that have come on this podcast, and we talk about balance and the importance of having other interests outside your sport. And it does seem, as long as you're not consumed or distracted by other elements in life, but having that broader perspective on what it is does make it more enjoyable.
Oh, 100%. Like, we talk a lot about inspiring the next generation in our GB7 setup. And the fact now that I can do coaching outside of that, it's allowed me to be able to, I want to inspire the next generation on the pitch, and it's allowed my confidence to be better.
Yeah.
So I'm more confident now because I want my young girls to look at me and think, gosh, I want to play like Abby. Like, I want to be ruthless like her on the pitch. I want to be destructive and I just want to be me. And that's kind of what I try to embody now on the pitch to try and inspire my young girls.
And for a bit of perspective, you now play full-time rugby.
Mm-hmm.
You are on the pathway to Paris 2024 and you coach. How do you fit it all in?
You know, I barely do actually fit it all in, but I love being busy, and sometimes it is to my own detriment, me being so busy. I think when you're passionate about something, you find time for it. And I'm passionate about, because I could easily go through the next year just playing professional rugby for 15s and for 7s. But actually, the thing that makes me tick and the thing that makes me whole is coaching young girls. I want to do that when I finish playing. So why would I not start doing it now?
Why do you think that is?
I think about the people who had such an impact on me when I was going through those ages of 16 to 18 years old. There's a coach called LJ Lewis who now coaches the England Under 20s programme. She's like my second mum. She's coached me ever since I was 16 years old, all the way through to when I was about 21 at Wasps. And she is unbelievable. She has shaped me to be the best woman that I am now. And that's what I want to give to other young girls coming through.
That is so magic. Serving others. Now, you were part of the Sporty AF series.
Yeah.
With Team GB. Now, that's pretty special, mm-hmm. to have been a part of that panel. What did you learn from being a part of that with those other Olympians?
Yeah, it was a really unique experience just to be able to learn about the other challenges that other women face in the sport. I think that a lot of the time people see us as these superhuman people and nothing ever hurts us or anything like that. But actually, just to be able to speak to other women about their experiences that they've had, the challenges, or some of them coming back from childbirth, which I think is absolutely crazy.
It's mental, isn't it? It blows my mind.
Honestly, thinking about having a baby and then coming back to rugby, I don't know if I could ever do that. And just the fact that there were at least three athletes there who were just incredibly able to share their experience of, one, being an athlete, but two, being a mother in professional sport, was super, super inspiring and so amazing to hear. And I was just felt super privileged to be a part of it. Just the fact that these women are so amazing in their own right, but then amazing as athletes as well, I find pretty cool. And I learned a lot from every single one of them.
Is there a trending theme there throughout that series where you could all connect and relate?
They don't let their challenges define them. And I think that is a super cool concept that every single female athlete went through within that series, that they all have their own challenges that they face, but they never let them define them.
In the series, you spoke a bit about strength,
mm-hmm.
and your superpower being your strength. Mm-hmm. What does strength mean to you?
For me, strength is a really powerful word that we always really associate with men. And I think that's the way that I see strength is so much different to how traditionally we used to see the word strength. And I want to be able to change the perception around that and use that word to empower women, because it empowers me.
Yeah.
It's empowered me for years that the strength that I have on the rugby pitch is to be able to bust through tackles, be able to beat people by just absolutely running over the top of them. That is what strength means to me. Strength means different to so many different people. It can be your mental strength, and I say I carry myself with a lot of that as well.
An abundance of that, Abby. an abundance.
But I just want to be able to change the perception around what is strong. Can women be strong? Yeah, we can be. That is one of the reasons why I carry that word so close to me is strength. That is my super strength on the pitch.
So for those people that want to check out that series, where can they find it and who's in it?
Yeah, so they can find it on YouTube, on the Team GB channels. On there, it involves a range of different athletes, from athletics, from cycling, from judo. It involves me and one of my really good friends, Kimberly Woods, who's recently just become world champion in, I'm pretty sure she's going to hate me because I always say it wrong. It's either canoe or kayak, but I think it's canoe.
I think it's canoe. It's canoe.
And she always hates me because I always say it wrong. Yeah. But yeah, it's a really cool series that talking about different challenges that women face, from like childbirth to mental health to periods, all of it. And yeah, it's a pretty cool series.
Now, talk to me a little bit about body image, because you've got a pretty special thing going on your Instagram.
Yeah.
Tell us about that.
Yeah, so recently, well, not as recently, before I was poorly, I ran a page called Absolutely Positive, which was about promoting body image. It was basically talking about that every person's body has like a purpose, whether that be us just walking up and down this river,
yeah,
or my purpose is I'm a doctor, so I've got to be able to be on my feet for so long. Like, everybody has a purpose. It's not just your body is not made to not do anything. It was a really, really big part of that. We didn't show that as women's rugby players, that our body is made for a purpose, that we all wanted to fit into this small mold of being like influencers and like models and stuff like that. And that was a really, really big thing, especially when I was growing up, and I wanted to show people that we don't have to look like that. And if I'm being honest, after I'd been ill, my body went through an absolute whirlwind of losing 20 kilos, putting back on 30 kilos, then like trying to find, like, I was like skinny but chunky, like it was so confusing. And I probably didn't show that much on my social media because I felt a bit ashamed of that.
Do you think that's important for you moving forward as a role model to share that for the next generation? And is that something that translates into your coaching?
1,000%. Me and some of my friends have had really good conversations about this because I'm not as active on that platform anymore, but I'm still a very good advocate for body image. What has stopped me from sharing that part of me? I don't actually know when I think about it, like why I haven't shared all of that with everybody. And I think because...
It is tiring though. It's work.
It is. And I think because my illness was such like a vulnerable part of my life and a really critical part of my life, that there were some things that I didn't want to share with everybody. But actually, after reflecting on it, my body went through absolute hell, like being 60 kilos and I went up to 90 kilos. Now I'm back down to like 85. Like, it's so confusing, but it's actually okay for me to be like that. Like, my body saved my life at the end of the day. If I wasn't as, yeah, literally.
Let's celebrate that.
It did. It saved my life. If I wasn't as muscular as what I was before I went into that coma, like if I was my mum's weight, my mum weighs about 65 kilos.
There'd she be nothing left of her.
Absolutely nothing left of her.
Wow.
So it's like, that is the main thing, that my body saved me. I need to show it more to people that's what was one of the main things that helped me through.
Let's celebrate that. That truly, truly.
Yeah.
Is so powerful. Now, body image is something that is often scrutinized in the media, on social media, trolling on the likes of Twitter. Rugby does have lots of different body types. Mm-hmm. As a player, is that something that you feel is still scrutinized in the media? Or do you think we are getting to a point where we're past that and there is a celebration of the capability of what our bodies can do?
I think yes and no. I think within rugby, because there are so many different body types, that people kind of look at us and think, oh yeah, that's it, there's so many different body types. But then even like you look at women's football at the moment, Beth Mead coming back for her ACL, the amount of comments that were on a social media post about how much bigger she had gotten from an ACL injury was ridiculous.
That's disgusting.
I was looking at it like thinking, she's just been through a traumatic experience, ACL tear. She hasn't been able to train.
And the loss of her mum as
exactly.
well.
Exactly. And then people commenting on her body. And I thought that was horrendous.
It's disgusting.
But it's like, still in women's football, people are put in a box, I think, that like they are a certain body shape and they have to look like that. I do think women's rugby is more accepting because everybody is so different. Like, people can go from one end of the spectrum to the other end of the spectrum. But I do think there is a place within women's sport and the media around women's sport that does need to be addressed and does need to be better.
I feel like we're slowly, slowly making steps
yes.
towards that. And I think you are a very big part of that. Mm-hmm. And especially with your platform going into the Olympics. Because we're on the road, right?
Yeah,
we're
we are on the road.
We're on the road. Casual, casual. Let's have a little flick of the ball. Go on. I have to ask you then. We ask every guest.
The way you're spinning that was not good.
Oh,
you went like
no.
this. And then you span like that, so that was good.
Okay, it's because I used to be a basketball. I used to play basketball. Shh, don't tell anyone that. I played on Sport Relief and everyone was like, wow, she's really good. I was like,
yeah, maybe yeah, I did it in a past life.
You What is your relationship like with Monday? And has it changed?
I do like a Monday, actually. Like,
has it changed since the incident?
I think just like my whole mornings, regardless of Monday, my whole mornings have changed. I like to try and get outside now and just look at the sky, which that's what I like to do. I know it sounds super strange, but when I was in the coma and I came outside for the first time, the first thing I did was just look up at the sky. And I actually was quite blinded at the time because I'd been inside so long. My relationship with Mondays, but just my relationship with mornings now has completely changed. I am a morning person. I'm not a night owl.
I love a little
if
morning as well.
If I can be in bed by 9 p.m.
That's a little bit keen.
But I just like to just be in my pyjamas and be asleep. So, but I say I wake up before 8 a.m. every morning, try and get outside, just have a routine. And that's what I love. So
get the
hot chocolate in. I do like a Monday, I have to say.
And lastly, Abby, do you have any life mottos or quotes that you'd like to share with our listeners to inspire them to take that one positive step out of bed on a Monday?
Ooh. The life motto that I live by is never giving in. So I have that tattooed on my foot. It's the Burton family motto. And that is something that I take in every single walk of life. But for me, to help people get out of bed in the morning, we can't take life for granted because it can be taken away from you like that. And I know it's probably so cliche, is that saying, but life can be taken away from you so quick, so we can't take it for granted. So get up and move in the morning.
Yes! We absolutely love that. Monday Mile listeners, it is a wrap. Abby, thank you so much for joining us here on the podcast. Hopefully this has fulfilled your needs of getting up early, having a little walk, and the sunshine has graced us. But you know what? I actually think it's you just gracing us with your presence on the podcast today. Monday Mile listeners, do make sure you do subscribe. The full audio will be available every single Monday morning from 1 a.m. for the really, really early risers. And make sure you do check out the Sporty AF Team GB series. And stay tuned to what's your Instagram?
My Instagram, my body image Instagram, is absolutely positive. And then all the Sporty AF stuff will be on Abby_Burton.
Monday Mile listeners, it is a wrap. Woo!